Good evening. This is John Coates here in Natick, Massachusetts. This tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. This is September 25th, 2000. And this evening we are pleased to have with us Alton Webb. Welcome, and I think we call you Al, don't we?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you,
Al, it's good to have you with us tonight.
Thank you. Can we
start by my asking you how old you are?
Yes, I'm 57, John.
Okay, and I'm instantly doing the math. You were born in 1942.
Yes, it is. That's correct.
Good. And what is your current address?
I live at the...
to us here.
Yes.
Are you married?
Yes, I'm married and have two children that are both married, a daughter and a son.
They're both married?
Yes.
Do you have grandchildren?
No grandchildren, no.
Okay. Well, that's going to be a blessing. Where were you born now?
Yes. I was born in Waltham, Massachusetts, at the Waltham Hospital, actually. Yes.
And were you raised in that area?
Yes, I grew right up in Waltham all my life. And then I came to Wayland in 1968, actually, to work for the town of Wayland.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there for over 30 years.
Oh, yes. What did you do there?
I was the town treasure collector for the Wayland, John, and I retired from the town after that many years of service in 1998, and since then just been doing part-time work.
Okay, that sounds like a good life.
Yes.
You were born in 1942, right smack in the middle of World War II. Was anybody in your family involved in that war?
Directly, my father was not ever in the service, but he worked for a company in Waltham that made rivets for the military, and that was the Judson Thompson Company.
Okay, and did you grow up hearing stories about that war? People would tell you about a guy named Hitler or the Normandy invasion, things like that. Was that part of your upbringing?
Yeah, it was partly somewhat. I had a very close cousin that was in the Marine Corps that actually was in about five different combats during the Second World War, and actually came through it fine and became a lieutenant in the Waltham Fire Department after that.
So, okay. So that was part of your growing up then?
It was.
Your dad worked in a place that made rivets?
Yes.
Was he some kind of a mechanic or engineer?
I actually did a lot of shipping of the rivets, actually, in the shipping department.
Yeah.
It was an old factory in Waltham, and I think the rivets were used somewhat to do with military equipment, John. I don't know exactly what... type
okay.
of equipment.
And what about your mother?
My mother was actually a nurse, a practical nurse. She also worked for a dentist for quite a few years, and then did this practical nursing and taking care of elderly people that were sick at home.
And was she in any way involved in wartime effort?
No, she wasn't.
No, she was a nurse for elderly people, you say?
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did I ask you if you had brothers or sisters?
No, you didn't, but I do have a sister that's 2 years older than myself.
Yeah, so she's 59 years old?
Yes. Yeah,
yeah.
She,
born in 1940?
Yes, yeah, okay. That's correct.
Can you tell us what Waltham, what you remember it being like when you grew up, a kid in a town like that?
I do, because they used to have a lot of wonderful parades in Waltham, and I remember... actually, a lot of the military were in the parades down there. They had the Legion Band that was Dot Slam, and that really was the leader of the band. She had done that for many, many years, just till recently. And
oh, of course. She's walked through Natick many a parade.
Yeah. And I had two nephews that were in the band, too. So over the past few years here, within the last 10 or 15 years, they were both in the band. And it was very nice because they got to travel quite a bit with the band overseas.
It was a very excellent band, as I remember.
It was, yes.
You went through the whole Waltham school system, did grammar school and into high school.
Yes.
So what year did you get into high school?
I think it would have been in 1956.
56.
Yes.
And that's when you entered it?
Yes.
Okay. And now you're here tonight because you were a veteran. When did you get into the service?
I actually joined the United States Marines Corps in 1960, of January 1960, John.
Joined the United States Marine Corps?
Yes, I did.
1960. Yes. Why did you join the Marine Corps in 1960?
Oh, I guess, you know, even as I was growing up through my teenage years and that, I always felt, I knew quite a bit about the Marines. I knew it was a very difficult, or pretty rugged outfit, you know, and the history of the Marines, I had read some about it, and I felt that I needed some you know, good discipline, and I knew I'd get it that way. It changed my life completely. I think, and even today, I look back, and it was quite an experience, a great experience for me. Really, it was.
Well, tell us about reading books and your interest in the Corps. Did you personally know any Marines? Anybody in the Corps?
Only my cousin that had served during the Second World War.
Yeah.
Other than that, I really didn't know any others that I can recall in the Marine Corps. But I think it was really just from hearing. I think at that time we had some. Maybe recruiters came into the school and that, and spoke to some of the students and things like that. I had gone down at that time in Waltham on the common were the different services. The Navy had a little small house there, a little shack sort of, and the Marine Corps did, and also the Army as well. And I had gone down and talked to the recruiter several times about maybe going in. And so when I, in January of 1960, I was able to leave in my senior year. If your grades were passing at that time, you could leave in January of that school year.
To enter the service.
Yes, you could.
Yeah. Did you talk to your cousin about going into the Corps?
I think I did. You know, we weren't really real close, but I had spoken with him a bit.
And did he encourage you to do this?
No, I don't think he did, to be honest with you. I don't think so. But I had an uncle that was in the Navy as well, too.
Okay, so you're bound for Parris Island, but can you tell us about talking to your folks about I'm going to go into the Marine Corps. What was their reaction to this?
I think they were a little skeptical about my going. Because they didn't want to see me leave. Naturally, we were very close. We didn't have it was just my sister and I. But I was pretty persistent about going in, and so they gave me the support. And sure enough, off I went and. Left from Boston, South Station, Boston, on train there.
Were you 17, 18,
yes,
just about 18?
Yes, I was 17, yes.
And what, for how long a period did you sign up?
For 4 years.
You were going to do a whole hitch in the Marine Corps?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Okay, now you're on a train at South Station. Were any other guys with you that you knew, or were you all by yourself?
There was one other fellow that was graduated from Waltham High School at the same time, and I did know him not really well, but we became good friends after we got in the service.
Who was he?
And his name was Melvin Brault.
And Melvin and you got on that same train?
Yes, we did.
And you drove down through Washington and Virginia to the Carolinas?
Yes.
I take it you were sent to Parris Island.
Yes, I was.
Tell us about arriving at Parris Island in 1960.
Well, I recall that it was kind of late in the day when we got down to a town called Yamasee, and we got off the train, and I think even before we got off the train, we had either drill instructors or people telling us and yelling at us to get off the train. We stood right beside the tracks. And the next thing I knew, we had to go into a Quonset hut, and they had us cleaning the head there, the urinals and commodes, and And that was our first assignment, I guess, and we just did what we were told, and a lot of screaming went on. And
What did they yell at you?
I think they just said, everybody off the train, get off the train.
They didn't say you'll be sorry?
I'm sure they did probably say that too, but but that was our first initiation there, and it was kind of dark. I remember getting on a bus. I don't recall if it was a Greyhound bus, but it was a bus heading out to Parris Island, and it was dark enough that you could still see the Spanish moss and the trees. And the smell in the air smelled different, you know, from the trees.
Yeah. You're a 17-year-old kid.
Yes.
And you're now in Parris Island, your first night there, and getting all your gear. Can you remember what you felt like? And maybe I made a mistake, or this is going to be great.
Sure. I was nervous, and I think that. You just didn't know what to expect. I know when we got to Parris Island, and even before we got off the bus again, there were people yelling at us to get off the bus, get in line, and then we all walked into a building there, and they had us actually sitting down, almost like a school classroom, and we sat at desks, and they would read out your name and the serial number, and you had to know that serial number right away. So you memorize that, and so when you went forward up to speak to them, they would ask you some questions, and we'd fill out some papers and so forth. You had to know that number right away. If you didn't know that number, boy, you were in trouble right away, so you soon learned your serial number. And
what was yours, Hal?
Mine was 1900819, yes. You know, because they would trick you by asking you later, as we went along through the 13 weeks, I guess it was, at Parris Island, that they would try to trick you with your rifle number, mm-hmm. and they'd say, ask you what your rifle number was, sometimes you'd say your serial number by mistake. That didn't always work too well either.
Tell us more about the kind of training you got. What did you do mostly at PI?
Well, I think the very beginning was mostly all, between classroom work, and sitting in classrooms, and they would instruct you on, various things, especially on rifle equipment. You had to know your rifle backwards and forwards.
What kind of rife did you have, Al?
It was an M1 that I...
The Grand Rifle?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes, and I had an 8-round clip that would go in that joint. And you had to be able to take that apart almost with your eyes closed and put it back together. And we would spend hours on the rifle range, of course. But also we trained for marching, we did an awful lot of marching and physical fitness, running. It didn't matter what the weather was, because in January it was kind of cold. And at Parris Island, as you know, there's a lot of sand fleas come out somewhere along the way in the spring there.
They made a whole movie out of that.
Too, yes they did, yeah. Yes. Yeah, and so you would get bit by those sand fleas, but you couldn't slap them at all, you couldn't move. Otherwise, boy, the drill instructor would just go up and down you, and really chew you out. If you tried to slap those fleas, so everybody just stood and put up with it. Really, and we found out that later by using the rifle oil that we had in the butt of our rifle, by putting that rifle oil on our faces, that seemed to help keep the sand fleas off of us. We found that out. So. We tried that.
That was very clever.
It seemed to work, yes.
Somewhere along here, you took a battery of tests.
Yes, they did.
To find out what your interests were,
yes.
and what the best use the Corps could make of you. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do.
Sitting there and taking those?
Yes, I do, yes.
So after 13 weeks or so, they called you out one day and told you where you were going to go.
Yes.
As a result of that testing.
That's right.
Was this guy still with you, your friend Melvin?
He had gone, I'm trying to think, I think after camp, you know, we had gone to advanced training after Parris Island, up to Camp Lejeune. At that point, I think he had gone to, he did go to Cherry Point for a while, too. We were stationed at Cherry Point, North Carolina.
But what was the day when they told you where you were going to go? What did they tell you you were going to do in the Corps?
I had my orders to, after I got through Parris Island, to go up to Camp Lejeune. I went up there by bus, and I had to report for advanced training up there. Actually, it was supposed to be, it must have been about a couple of months training that we had up at Camp Lejeune. It was actually Camp Geiger, which is part of Camp Lejeune.
But you were assigned to the Marine Corps Infantry then?
Yes, it was.
And so you were sent up to North Carolina?
Yes, it was.
And what did you think of that assignment?
It was a relief to be out of Parris Island, you know, and it was people that were called troop handlers that instead of drill instructors were in charge of you there. It was a little bit more freedom than at Parris Island. We didn't have any liberty at Parris Island at all, but only at night you would have maybe an hour or so to write letters home, clean your boots, clean your rifle, and that was pretty much it. But up at Camp Lejeune there, we had a little bit more freedom. So on weekends, sometimes we would have a little liberty to go into town. Sometimes I would walk about 4 or 5 miles into Jacksonville, North Carolina, just for something to do. I would call home, things like that.
The assignment you got in the Marine Corps Infantry, would you rather have done something else in the Corps?
Yes.
And was there any way you could change that assignment? Could you sit down with somebody and say, look, I'd rather fly, or I'd rather swim, or something else?
Yes.
Did you do any of that?
I did try that, yes. I was trying to get into communications.
Yeah.
And I got to, at one point, I was going to go to school up at Norfolk, Virginia for communications. I was able to talk to the gunnery sergeant that was in charge of our unit there at Cherry Point. There I worked out of a hangar, and we had C-119 planes. I was in aircraft supply, and we had C-119 aircraft, which are real large. At that time, they were pretty large transport planes.
And how did you get to Cherry Point?
Once I finished my advanced training at Camp Lejeune, then I got orders to report to Cherry Point. But I did go home on liberty for about a month after I finished my advanced training at Camp Lejeune. And I was there about a couple of months. I missed out on my graduation from high school because I had missed duty for a month at Camp Lejeune as well. And by the time I get back, it was about 6 months later from the time I went in. So it was probably July, I guess, by the time I get home.
Oh, so you missed your high school graduation.
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah.
Who came and got your certificate? Your family came?
Yes, my mother always said she was going to help me get my diploma because she had helped me through school, studying and everything. She was wonderful. And she kept saying, I'm going to get your diploma one of these days. And sure enough, it turned out that way because she ended up going up at the Embassy Theater in Waltham. And Mayor Rose at the time presented her with my high school diploma. And that was in 1960, it would have been. I had missed out on all the kind of the fun of my graduation, unfortunately.
That's too bad. If I'm following this correctly, we're about in July now of 1960.
Yes, it is.
And you're at Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Yes.
And what is your assignment now?
Now, I'm really with the 2nd Marine Air Wing, and I was with an outfit called VMR 353, which was a squadron, a supply, it was C-119 planes, as I had mentioned, which was for aircraft. And my position was to obtain parts for aircraft to if planes were out of commission, my job was to go and get the parts for the planes so that they could get back into the air.
Okay, stop there a second. Tell us about a C-119, and tell us at this time in world history, what is the United States Marine Corps doing with these planes?
Yeah, really what we were doing is transporting troops to different various bases. Sometimes we would take them even to Air Force bases down to Homestead, Florida, because during that time, a little later on, I think it was probably around 1961, where the Cuban crisis started in, and that was with Russia sending ships to Cuba, mm-hmm. and missiles being set up in Cuba that were aimed at the United States. And our mission there was to send troops down to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, down to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We were always sending planes somewhere, different missions to take supplies to troops, you know, down at various bases they would
be on. President Kennedy, Jack Kennedy was the President of the United States.
Yes.
What did you hear about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and how did you feel that would affect you and the work you were doing?
I didn't know if I would be sent, you know, actually I volunteered to go if need be, you know, to Cuba or wherever I had to be. I put in for duty, and I didn't get chosen, but I did have some friends that did go on the USS Boxer, which ended up down near the Cuba and surrounding the island down there, and just there was actually no fighting actually took place. Russia backed down from that whole mm-hmm. Mission there. They were able to, you know, President Kennedy actually, I guess, forced them, you know, forced their
okay.
hand.
Okay, tell us about your contact with or exchange with people who were going to Gitmo or going to Florida, and how close they felt they were to the invasion of the island of Cuba.
Gee, I think that we felt pretty close because we had troops come up from Camp Lejeune, and we had men all over our barracks, sleeping on the floor, sleeping in the hangar, just about every place you could think of came up from Camp Lejeune. Heavy equipment came up from Camp Lejeune, trucks, oil trucks. The Air Force came in. We thought our planes were large, and then the Air Force planes came in, and we saw the size of some of those, and we were putting vehicles on there that were going down to Florida, to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There was all kinds of equipment. Heavy equipment I'm speaking about, and we really thought that there was going to be certainly something going to take place. We were on the on standby.
You felt war was imminent.
It was very close.
The invasion of Cuba was imminent.
Yes, it was very close.
Tell me, Al, that close to a situation like that, what did the Corps do to prepare you? Telling you what was involved. Did you have, I don't know what to call these political action meetings, where you were told what was happening and why? And did you have access to television broadcasts?
Yes.
How did you get your news?
Yeah. Well, really through television, yes, we heard it on the news a lot. But also the squadron, we would have musters throughout the day. They would brief us on, you know, where our planes were going and so forth. And so the higher ups, we had a lieutenant colonel that was in charge of our squadron, briefing us on, you know, what was taking place and so forth. Some of these things we really didn't know almost till very close to the time when this all took, you know, the ships from Russia were already heading our way, I think, at the time. And so I don't think we were really briefed until pretty close to, you know, when all this all started happening right away. But they did keep us pretty well posted on what was, you know, what things, the way things were progressing.
Can you tell us specifically what you were told?
My recollection would be that I think I was just, you know, just told that, you know, that we were definitely on standby, that there's a possibility that we could be shipped out, our unit, and that, and there again, I wasn't told where we would be going, but I had a good idea, maybe it was down to the Florida area or something.
You would go to Florida, or would you go to Guantanamo itself?
Yes, I think it was one of the...
Did some of your planes go to Guantanamo?
Yes, they did.
So they went to Cuba?
Yeah, they did, John, yes.
And did you talk to any of the people who made those runs?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Can you tell us about their experiences, what they told you?
I think I know one experience where one of our planes actually had some trouble. We had put a lot of troops on there from Camp Lejeune, and one of our planes developed a hydraulic leak, and they no sooner had taken off from Cherry Point, came around, turned right around, came right back, and all the men were all soaking with hydraulic fluid. They were all coming off the plane, so we had to send out another plane right away, and because I was off and running, getting parts for the plane to get it back up into the air, but I think that the experience, it was, being pretty close to war at the time, but as I say, we were pretty well, at that age, I guess you don't seem to have too much fear, you know, I mean, still you're a little scared, but I think, you do volunteer for things to do, and I volunteered to go wherever I had to go, I would have, but...
Okay. It's in my head, and I'm not sure of this, the Cuban crisis was sometime October, maybe?
I think it was.
Late in the fall, and you had arrived in Cherry Point in July.
Yes.
Cherry Point in July is a very hot place to be. It's out on the coast, and there's not much to do. You go into New Bern, and that's about it.
Yes, it is.
What did you do? What specifically was your job there?
I was really in charge of getting all the supplies for the plane, like, in other words, parts, I should say, for the planes that were out of commission. I would go, say, I would be told by, say, our engineering department in the squadron or the metal department, you know, sheet metal department, they would need certain things for the plane, pumps and things like this here. So they would come up to us with a requisition, and we would go ahead and take that, and we would go down over to another hangar, not another hangar, but excuse me, to another supply building, which was like a wing supply, and we would ask to see if they had the part there. If it wasn't there, they would send us to Navy Supply, which is another larger building on the base, and if they couldn't get it there, then they would go off base, and we would have to wait till that part came in. So in the meantime, the plane would be just sitting there, you know, not too much we could do till we get that part in. Once we get the part in, we would get a call from whoever it would be on the base there, saying that usually it was Navy Supply. And
are you saying Navy Supply?
Yes, it was. It was called Navy Supply. It was a real large building, and it was called Navy Supply. And we would go down and pick up that part. Now, depending on the size of the part, we would have to go to the motor pool to get the type of vehicle we would need to get it. I drove a lot of different types of forklifts. In one case, we needed a wing for a plane that had crashed down in Guantanamo Bay, actually.
A whole wing?
Yes, a whole wing.
And you order it up like a spark plug?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes, we did. Yes, yeah. It was all crated. And we would have to, we had real large forklifts that I drove, and we would go pick it up and bring it right to another plane to fly down to wherever it had to go. And so that was my job. I could drive a lot of different types of vehicles, really anything real, real large, like a semi, you know, an 18-wheeler type truck or something like that. I didn't have a license to drive that size, but I did drive 6x5s. Yeah. Weapons carriers.
You were in VMR 53?
Yes, 353.
353.
Yes, it was, John.
Oh, good. Yeah. How many planes did you have in your squadron?
Oh, boy.
How many of these giant planes were in your squadron?
I'm kind of guessing.
Say 6, 8, 12, yeah, 15.
I think it probably maybe a dozen planes.
A dozen of these things. That's a lot of hardware to keep track of, isn't it?
Yes.
And were there any other types of planes in your squadron?
No, it was strictly that type of plane, yeah.
Were there fighter planes on your at Cherry Point?
Yes, there were.
Corsairs, 6Fs,
yeah. There was lot of Phantom F4s, Phantoms that came in there. We had squadrons of those. I don't know a lot about planes, but there was a lot of other type of planes that came in there, too. Navy planes were there, and although most of them were, you know, the Marine Corps, of course, as I say, like the Phantom, and
were they all jets?
Yes, they were. Yes.
Including these 119s.
And those were all prop planes.
Those were props.
Yes, they were. Yeah. They were.
What was your rank by this time?
Yes,
Al?
I think maybe I may have been like either a private first class or lance corporal at that time.
You told me you got to be a corporal at a pretty early age.
Yes.
Some guys are in the Corps 20 years before they get two stripes.
Yeah. I advanced fairly rapidly.
How come?
I don't know. I guess we had in our supply area. I think it was we had a warrant officer that was in charge. We had a gunnery sergeant that came under him, and we had I believe it was two sergeants, and we had I think it was three other men, myself and two other men, that were like private first class, and there was room for advancement up to corporal. So as time went on, I advanced to lance corporal and then to corporal. So I think I was about just about 18, maybe when I finally made corporal.
Oh, that's good for you.
thank you.
You hadn't been in the Corps that long. We're talking about October of 61.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And you're in a crisis, really, situation that we could go to war, or at least the invasion of Cuba. Or war with Russia on a larger scale. Can you go back enough years to think about how you felt and the guys around you felt about this? Mm-hmm. From a pretty good job at Cherry Point, you guys are on the brink of something pretty big.
Yes.
Can you tell us how that felt?
Well, you know, we were very close. We were a close group of men there that, you know, we trained. You know, our training, you know, through all our training all the way along, it was geared to going into combat or war. And so I think we all felt that we were capable of whatever we needed to do. I don't think anybody would back down at all. It was actually, I think, you know, we accepted the that position that you know, whatever it took, we would do, and I think everybody felt that closeness about helping one another. We were very close. I had an awful lot of friends that, and I still do even today. But I think at that time we were a very close unit, and I think it really just developed by training with one another. You know, living closely together. I lived in the barracks all the time I was in the service, And as I advanced, you know, I had to tell other men what to do, and we were also throughout the squadron I was in was very very gung-ho outfit. We trained every day with physical fitness. Every morning we would go outside, march, and we would have to qualify each year, you know, in the rifle range, and we did a lot of physical fitness, PT. Every single day we did that. And even at noontime, we would, there was a certain time period that we would run. Some miles of running and that type of thing. And then, of course, we had all types of inspections naturally.
Sure. But was there a rifle range at Cherry Point?
Yes.
So you haven't been in the Corps a year yet.
Yes.
But did they say you guys better review a lot of the stuff you did at either PI or Camp Lejeune, your infantry tactics, in addition to your aviation work now?
Yes.
were you getting more rehearsals about how to fire that Garand?
Yes.
So they took you back up to the rifle range?
We did a lot of that. Yes, we did, too. Yes, we did. Also trained with other types of weapons, too. You know, we had rocket launches that we practiced with. And I think there was some other type of,
I think they were called like a grease gun. They were actually a type of a machine gun. And Browning automatic rifles were another type of weapon that we trained with, too.
Rocket launches, various types of weapons, of course. And we had also trained with that at Camp Lejeune, too, before we got to Cherry Point.
Did you guys think it through to the extent that you didn't know if you would be fighting Cubans or Russians?
I don't know if we really really realized who we would our enemy was going to be. I think we thought probably Russia, but you know, in Cuba perhaps. But I think we thought in terms of Russia more than we did probably of Cuba, because that seemed to be where the ships were coming in from. You know, so I think we were looking at that more so perhaps.
You're in still in the Carolinas, and you've been through a summer there, and you're getting into your second winter in the Corps. Were you clothed properly? Were you wearing clothes not too light, not too heavy, but
yes,
properly equipped for the climate you were in?
Yes, we were, John. Yeah, we were issued different types of clothing, such as utility type, they're almost like a dungaree material, I guess you'd call them. We used to call them utility trousers, you know. And they were, that was our uniform of the day, that mostly because we would be always working in warehouses. I worked a lot of warehouses that we kept all of these supplies. Of course, the uniforms, you know, our dress uniform would be greens. During the winter, of course, and they would come in a certain time of year. You would have to change over to your greens or your. We also had I guess it was sort of a gabardine type uniform that we would wear throughout the summer months.
Your khakis.
Khakis. Yes, they were.
Before this interview, you showed me a picture of you in dress blues.
Yes.
How did that come about? Where did you get the dress blues?
Yeah, you know, it was really a fellow that was leaving had been discharged from the Marines, and he didn't take his dress blues with him, and I guess he didn't think he was going to need them, so he gave them to me, and that's how I got them. He was from California, actually, out Oregon, and that's kind of how I obtained that, and they fit me all right, so I think I had some tailoring done, but they fit me okay. And
you look great.
Thank you.
How would you, you mentioned before that the officer in charge of your unit was a warrant officer.
Yes.
How would you weigh at this distance the quality of the leadership you got?
Gee, I think it was very good. It was very
from him or other officers in your unit.
We got a lot of support from the higher-ups throughout our unit. The gunnery side was there day-to-day, and also the warrant officer usually would come in quite a bit, too. I couldn't tell you exactly all their duties, but they would oversee what we had to do. We were in charge of all the equipment for all the pilots of the planes, getting all their flight gear, flight suits. We had to make up packets so that they could obtain gasoline at various bases for our planes when they landed, and they needed gasoline for refueling our planes. They had to have certain vouchers made up so that they could get that voucher and get the fuel for the plane. When they came back to Cherry Point, they would turn all that paperwork in to us. We would have to take that paperwork and submit it to Fleet Aviation, a county office in Virginia. It would all have to be sent up there for processing and so forth. So not only did we do, being in warehouse work and
taking care of the barracks, all the linens for the troops in the barracks, and weaponry. We were in charge of all the armory for the barracks as well. We ended up doing a lot of paperwork too as well. So there was some accounting involved. And I guess that's kind of where I got my experience as I came out of the service to kind of go on to become, into that type
of
field.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of these things takes off, C-119 takes off from Cherry Point.
Yes.
And is going to Guantanamo and back. And when it comes back, you get a briefcase full of papers for expenditure for gasoline.
Yes.
Oil, equipment for the plane. So what about food and the checking into mess halls on other bases? Was that all part of what you had to do?
No, it wasn't. Most of the food that we supply the crew with food enough for they were almost like box lunches.
Yeah.
We would go out on the flight deck in a jeep. And if we knew there was, four or five crew that were going to be on that plane, we would make sure that they had enough food on there to get to wherever their destination was going to be.
Okay.
From that point on, then wherever they were, at, they would get the supplies, the needed supplies.
Come this Cuban Missile Crisis, as it came to be called, what kind of hours were you working? Pretty stringent, a lot of traffic going in and out of your base.
Yes, we were on duty, we were actually on standby 7 days a week. I mean, there was no really let up during that time. I mean, we could go, to the movies. We could stay on the base. I don't believe that they wanted you going off the base, but we could go to the base and we could go to the movies, that kind of thing. But you had to always check out with the officer of the day at the barracks, say the sergeant that was on duty at the barracks, you would have to let them know where you were going to be at all times. Yes.
But you guys were working pretty hard.
Yes.
And were you part of any the crews that loaded stuff on planes? If they carried 50,000 pounds of stuff, who was in charge of loading all that?
I don't recall that we had people that were, troops that were would help us, get that on board. I mean, we were responsible for getting that part to the plane. Usually, we did a lot of this right in the hangar because the hangar would actually hold two aircraft in the hangar, so a lot of that could be loaded on right there before we even got, had it sitting out in the flight line out there, but most of that would be brought in by forklift, and we did some of that, yes we did, and then other departments would help too as well. If it was engineering and so forth, we would have troops, helping like that, yes.
You said you had about a dozen planes in your squadron. When one of these breaks down or loses a wing in Guantanamo, what did this do to your cycle of getting these planes in and out of the hangar and into the air where they belong?
Well,
did that really screw you up?
Yes. It does. It depends on how the need for that particular plane and the voucher that would come through from whatever department that needed that particular part. If it was, I don't recall the exact terms, but it would be an urgent type of voucher, or it would be an immediate, type voucher that you would have, they would need that part immediately, as soon as possible, And there was certain terminology, I don't recall the exact terminology, but, to get that particular part as quick as we possibly could. And so we would put out a certain type of bulletin, so that we could get that particular part as quickly
as possible.
That plane couldn't be down for very long. They wanted that back up as quick as we could get it. Yes.
I just thought of a question. Maybe I should ask you. Were you aware of the fact that as you got into the fall of that year, and the President of the United States gets up and says, we're eyeball to eyeball with Nikita Khrushchev, Were they beginning to call back reserve guys, people not in the general cycle you were in the Corps, but did they call up reserves?
I don't recall that they did at that time, John. I think all I recall is that we had troops coming up from Camp Lejeune immediately, and they were arriving at our base at Cherry Point, and we had them, as I say, in all, not only our squadron, but many of the squadrons on the base. There was, I couldn't even tell you how many squadrons were at Cherry Point, but all throughout the base were troops from Camp Lejeune, all ready to be shipped out to wherever they had to go.
How about technical people, people like you?
Yes.
Mechanics, aircraft mechanics, ordnance men?
Yes.
Did you have enough of them?
Yes. Yes, we did. I think if we didn't have them at Cherry Point, they would bring them in from other bases. Yes, they did. And of course, we weren't too far from New River, which was the helicopter base. Which supported on each coast. Usually you have your air squadron, your Second Marine Air Wing, then you have Camp Lejeune, which is the ground troops, and you usually had at that time another base, which was your helicopters base, which was New River, and that was all within about 40 miles of each other. So those planes could, that type of, you would have sufficient people to draw on, for what you needed, depending on your needs, yes.
I'm not sure at your level you would have been aware of this or maybe just noticed it, but what about your liaison with the West Coast and all the Marine Corps power out on the West Coast? Was that feeding through you guys or directly down to Florida? Do you know how that worked?
I don't offhand, I'm thinking of Altura, California was a big, another air station out there in California.
Miramar was,
too. Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't know for sure, no I don't, John, how that worked. I'm sure they were on standby too, just like we would be too, but us being a little closer, of course, we would be sent first right away, but I'm sure they were on standby too. I know they would be, yes they would.
You mentioned getting home for a month somewhere in there.
Yes.
Did you discuss with your family what you were doing, and were they concerned at the time all of this broke out? You could make long distance calls or whatever.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the home front reaction to your being in the Corps on the brink of something pretty big?
Well, yes, I think my folks were very concerned about what's going on because we were always so close, but I think they felt, that I would reassure them that things were going well. Maybe sometimes you would tell a few, a little bit of a white lie there, but usually things were going pretty well. We couldn't say a whole lot. They didn't want you to say too much about some of the things that were taking place. But in my letters to my folks, I wrote all the time, I would say, that this is kind of what's happening and so forth. And I kind of let that go that way. But yes, my folks were very concerned. And they came down a couple of times. They came down to visit, actually, down at Cherry Point, too.
Did they really?
Yes, they did, yeah.
That's nice.
A vacation, yes.
By any chance, do your letters still survive?
I think my mother has a couple of my letters. I'd have to look and see. I think she does somewhere. Yes, I'm sure she does. She's moved from her home in Waltham to my sister's house, so I don't know where those are at the moment, but yes, there were some letters, yes.
If you could dig those out, we'd like to see those.
Yes.
Those are historical documents, and talking about a time which was very crucial to the United States and very dicey at the time. You lived through it, so you know.
Yes, I'd be more than glad to try to see if I could obtain those too, John.
You haven't mentioned your friend. Let's see, what was his name?
Yes, it was
Melvin.
Yes, it was a fellow named.
Where is he all this time?
Melvin Brock. Well, he was actually with a different squadron. He was with a MAG outfit, which was pretty much on the go. That was a Marine Air Group squadron,
And he was, I'm not certain, to be honest with you. We did lose contact along the way because he was on his, you know, with a different outfit. And so he ended up going over to Japan, and after that we kind of parted.
You know, in a group, or was he on a carrier?
I don't know if it was still a squadron, you know, a MAG outfit, the Marine Air Group outfit that he was with, but I don't know. I do know that they went over to Japan.
Okay.
I'm not sure, John.
Just wondered if you kept in touch.
Yeah, no, we kind of drifted our own way. Yes, we did.
What did you do after the Cuban Missile Crisis? And you've got 3 more years to serve in the Corps. What did you do?
Well, you know, it was pretty much the same thing all the time. I mean, we continued to, you know, always have to bring in supplies for planes. You know, it was, we were always seemed to be on the go somewhere. I couldn't tell you where always planes were going, because that was sort of out of operations area. There was a department called operations.
Sure.
So I don't know where they all went to. Sometimes they would go to Memphis, Tennessee, or different places. But we continued to, you know, supply all the troops with, you know, clothing, weapons. You know, as I say, all the linens that they needed for the, you know, sleeping and that type of thing. That pretty much continued right out.
For 3 years, yeah.
For the next 3 years, yes, it did.
Did you personally fly, sometimes get in one of these things?
Yes, I did, yes.
Did you get flight pay?
No, I never got flight pay, but I just went on more of a Liberty Hops type thing.
Okay, you needed 4 hours a month for flight pay, I think.
I don't know how that worked, because I never received that.
But took a hop occasionally?
Yes, I did.
Where did you go?
Yes, I went down to Miami at one time, and then I came up to Pease Air Force Base. I was able to get home on a long flight, you know.
Good for you.
A four-day type pass, and we came into Pease Air Force Base. We had a difficult time getting in there. That was kind of a difficult trip, because we ran into very severe weather. And we had a lieutenant colonel that was flying the plane, and another gentleman that was, I believe, either a lieutenant or a captain that was on the plane too. By the time we came up the coast and we had landed at Floyd Bennett Field in New York, we had let off so many men to visit, you know, in that area, Philadelphia, New York area. And then we flew up, and I think we only had maybe 4 or 5 was still on the plane, as well as the crew.
And it got pretty hairy because of the weather.
Trying to get in, yes. Yeah, we had a tough time. It took us about 3 times to get in. And I called my folks from Floyd Bennett Field in New York, just telling them that I was on my way, and they were going to meet me at Pease Air Force Base. And I thought we'd be up there in so many hours. And of course, Elston was starting to try to land, and it was pitch black, and I looked out, and I could see lightning, and next thing I could see that we were over trees, and next thing we were going back up again, and finally, the third time we tried going down, the captain on the plane came back and said, "We're going to make one more attempt. If we can't, we're going to Burlington, Vermont," and that was out of the range of the storm, so we were able to get down the third time.
Oh, good.
We did land, yeah, we were all right.
So, your 4 years are up, and the Marine Corps said, "Are you going to ship over?" And why didn't you?
Yes. Well, you know, I guess really I was looking forward to getting out to do something different.
You're 22 years old now?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Okay.
I was going, yes. And I think that I might have stayed in, because I had a lot of friends that did stay in. But I think at the time, where I hadn't had the experience of traveling too much, I think I was disappointed a little bit in mm-hmm. not being able to travel. I put in for Japan once anyway, to go over to Japan. I put in for, you know, as I say, other areas to go up to get into communications, which fell through kind of at the last minute. And so I think I was a little bit disappointed because of that.
At that time,
yes.
Was the Corps looking for guys to stay in? Did they
yes.
offer you
yes, they did.
Incentives like going to Japan if you signed up?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
And you said, no, I'm going
yes.
home.
Yes, yeah, they did. It was the Vietnam had started already, actually it had already begun, and I think that's really where I was heading for. Not that I wouldn't have gone at all. If I had stayed in, I would have welcomed that. Sometimes I feel a little guilty about that because I had a lot of very close friends that went over there, and some didn't come back. So I feel a little guilty about that. But
Raymond, say that again.
Yes.
You had friends
yes.
in the Corps
yes.
who went to Vietnam?
Yes, they did, John.
How,
yes.
How did that come about?
Well, they had almost served out their 4 years of service, you know, at that time, and then they were shipping a lot of troops over to Vietnam, and so I had a very good friend from Newton. When we joined all of us together, I didn't know these fellows at all, but when we get down to Parris Island, we became pretty good friends. We found out there was five fellows from Newton that had joined at the same time. And on the train going down, the troop train going down to Parris Island, we became kind of close friends,
yes.
the five of us from Newton and the two from Waltham. And because Waltham and Newton were great rivals in football, so we had something in common there.
You stayed in touch with them for the
yeah.
4 years?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And then you heard they were going
yes.
to NAM?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that, how you heard it.
And yes. Well, I knew that one fellow, his name was Rico Pignano from Newton, was going over there, and he was in, he was actually stationed at Camp Lejeune. So
he was infantry.
Yes, he was in infantry. Yes, he was, and he had to do with trying to do with mines, to disassemble mines and that type of thing. I don't know what exactly you call that, but anyway. He unfortunately, a mine did explode and was killed that way. And so this was after I had got out of the service, and shortly thereafter he had was killed over there, and he was engaged to be married. And so all of us went to his funeral in Newton, and all of us from Waltham and the other four fellows from Newton all went. And it was pretty sad because, as I say, even though I didn't know him, we kind of went our own ways because he was stationed at a different base, but still we were pretty close, and so we went. And his father asked us all to come into the kitchen, and he said, he seemed to want us to be with us more so than he did with his own family. He wanted to know what his son had done in the Marines, you know, and this type of thing. So we sat in the kitchen talking to him about that. It was very difficult, and it was a hard time. But I guess that's kind of why I felt a little bit guilty about maybe not serving over there, because I did have another good friend that went over too. But he came back. He did two tours over there. He came out a master sergeant, and he did 10 years in the Marines. And I still keep in touch with him. He's from Sparta, Tennessee, and his name is Jerry Clark, and a very good friend. He and I were on the judo team at Parris Island together, and we got to go to the All-Marine Judo Tournament at Parris Island. Over the years, we competed with all the Marine bases from all over the United States. And they came from 29 Palms, California, from Camp Pendleton, all the different bases. So I get to compete against a lot of different people, and it was really interesting. But Jerry's been, we've been close friends. We always send Christmas cards and write, you know. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to get down. He lives on a farm in Sparta, Tennessee.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Can I back up a second here?
Yes, John.
Can I ask you a kind of personal question here? After all this time that's elapsed since you sat in the kitchen with that man's father, do you still feel guilty about not having gone to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. Yes, I do. I think I still feel it. Maybe I guess I felt that that was part of my job I was trained to go, for combat, and I guess maybe I felt that by getting out, even though I wasn't really aware where I was going to be stationed after 4 years, if I would go over to Vietnam, but my chances were pretty good that I was going to go over there. I wasn't really aware of that at the time when I did get out. I think I was just happy to be out, and looking forward to doing something different. But I still, in the back of my mind, did feel a little guilty about not, where we lost so many men over there. I often think that, I felt that I should have been part of that.
Yeah. We'll never know.
Yes.
Let me ask you, Al, was there a most memorable experience of your entire career in the Corps? Well, one thing that pops out all the time.
Yes, there is. It's probably a little bit comical in a way. Excuse me, just one moment.
Sure. Help yourself.
Mm-hmm. It was really at Cherry Point. I was I think I was either a private first class or a Lance Corporal at the time, and we had what they call duty driver, which was you had to spend a weekend in the hangar, and you lived right in the hangar, and the officer of the day would be there. Usually it was a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant that would be on duty. And we would get, box lunches for the flight crews still, and I would drive a Jeep and go out on the flight line and make sure that the pilots and so forth had their supplies and that type of thing. But at the same time, we slept in the operations area of the hangar. Mm-hmm. This was a regular, like an office type structure. And anyway, I was on duty there, and he was going, it was about 5 o'clock in the evening, and he was going to chow. He lived off base, this second lieutenant, and he said to me, I don't recall whether I was a private first class or not, but he said, private first class, Webb, I want you to take this list of names, which is probably about 20 names on a sheet, and he said, I want you to call everyone on this list here and tell them that Plan 2-60 has gone into effect. And when you finish that list...
Are you going to tell us what 2-60 is?
Yes. Well, what it was really was a command from the from our squadron, from the lieutenant colonel would have got that notice from the base command saying Plan 2-60. That was an emergency situation where all the planes would fly out of there to wherever we had to go. And so I didn't realize this, but what it all entailed. But anyway, and he went to chow to his home off base, he said, I want you to call all these people. So I started to call, and I had a phone right there, and I'm sitting at a desk, and I started calling, and I'm getting, crew chiefs, and I'm getting some pilots, of course, and other type of people that would, be on the aircraft, to fly the aircraft. And so I went through this whole list of names calling these people. And so by the time I got to the last name on the list, I went back and started to recall again. And I'm getting everybody's wives. And they're saying, oh, yes, he's on his way. And I said, well, I'm just calling back to confirm that 2-60 is in effect. And oh, yes, he's on his way. So now I'm getting a little bit worried, I'm saying, gee, I hope I get this right. So he didn't explain the whole thing to me, when he had gone, the second lieutenant. But anyway, within about 20 minutes to half an hour, people were coming in with suitcases. The whole place was buzzing in that office there. And they wanted to know what was going on. They were all set to get onto the planes. And I said, well, all I know is, what I've been told. And so, because he came back from, from his home, from chow there, and his face nearly turned white as a ghost. And, I explained that, I called, and so anyway, the lieutenant colonel showed up of our outfit. And the next morning we were told, to report to his office immediately in the morning at 0800 to be standing tall in front of him at that time, the both of us. So we went in and And I can remember sitting in that operations office even prior to 0800 in that morning, sitting there just waiting for that meeting, and I'm saying, boy, I know I'm going to lose a stripe over this, you know. And he was worried too, of course, and he didn't say anything to me at all. And we both went in, and all of a sudden the lieutenant colonel said to me, he said, you know, Private First Class Webb, he said, I just want to tell you, you know, that, you know, from now on, this is what this all means and so forth. But I was excused, and then I guess he went up one side and down the other side of this lieutenant, for not instructing me properly on what this whole thing meant. But he said at the same time to me when I was in there that it was a great exercise, and he was very proud that everybody showed up on time, and it was a great exercise. So all my friends still kid me today about that whole experience, and we had quite a time. I didn't have that duty driver for months after that, and so things went along for 4 or 5 months, and I didn't have that at all. And the next time I got that duty, that same lieutenant was on duty. And so anyway, before he went to, you know, chow at 5 o'clock that evening, he said to me, he said, I'm going to go over this plan 2-60 again with you, you know. And so I said, I think I'm pretty sure I understand what, you know. He said, it's only if you get a phone call from the lieutenant colonel, you know, from the squadron command, that this has gone into effect, then you call these people, but don't call anybody unless you hear directly from somebody like that. So myself, so anyway, I said, no, I understood. So he said, and anything else happens, you let me know. So I was sitting there, and I was looking out the window out in the flight line, and we had a place where we washed the planes, and it was a Quonset hut out there. And so a lot of planes would be washed out there, John. So I'm looking out there, and sure enough, there was a fire in the Quonset, going on the side of the Quonset, all in flames out there. I don't know if it was oil fire or what it was. And I'm looking out, and I said, oh my goodness, that's on fire. So anyway, I get on the phone, and I called that lieutenant at his home, and I said, you know, Lieutenant so-and-so, I said, this is Private First Class Webb calling, I said. And I said, and there's out on the flight line, out at the on the Quonset hut there, there's a fire going right now. And I said, so, and the crash crew trucks hadn't arrived yet or anything. So he said, I'm on my way in. And he said, and that thing better be burning when I get in there, he said to me like that. And I said, I hope it is.
I'll start another one.
Yeah. So that was kind of a, I guess one of the experiences I'll never forget.
No, you won't. Yeah. When and where were you discharged?
I was discharged from Cherry Point, North Carolina, on January 30th of 1964.
They held you 4 years, didn't
they? Yes, they did.
And with
yes.
What rank did you yes. have at that time?
I was a corporal.
Corporal?
Yes, E4.
Any
yes.
specific decorations that you had?
The only decoration I had, John, was the Medal of Good Conduct, which is...
So you were a good guy for 4 years.
Yes, I tried to be. Yes, I sure did.
Yeah. Did you join any reserve unit after you came home?
I was in the inactive reserve,
yeah.
Because at that time you had to serve 2 years inactive reserve time. So I was really discharged, and I think it was in December of 65 was my actual discharge date from the military. But because I had really kind of signed up about a month in December of actually 1959. I went in 1960, January of 1960, but I really signed up about a month mm-hmm. before that. And so my actual 6 years were really up in December of 1960.
So it's 4 years active duty and two inactive.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was.
And
yes.
Did you join any veterans organizations when you came home?
No, I didn't.
Why not, Al?
Yeah.
Or,
I guess, I don't know, to be honest with you. I guess I started working. I worked for a bank, and so I think I just got busy. I went to school nights under the GI Bill, and I was going to Burdett College in Boston, and I went in there. And so I think I just didn't have the time to do too much. I started right in, right away. After I came out in January of 1964, I just started working mm-hmm. within
just a couple of months after I got a job with a bank and I started right in.
You had things to do, right?
Yep. Yes. I think those organizations are wonderful, though. They do. We did have the USO came to our base. We had Lionel Richie came to Cherry Point and perform for us. We did have people like that that did come to the base.
Oh, that's yes. Lucky for you.
Yes.
What kind of reception did you get when you came home? You had been, not in wartime, but you had been through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did you talk with your family or others about what you'd done in the Corps?
Yes, I did. I spoke to my folks, you know, and told them a lot of things that had taken place. You know, they wanted to know, because they had, I was fortunate to, where I was stationed in the United States and on the East Coast, I was able to get home every year pretty much for Christmas. I always took my leave at Christmas time, so I was able to get home so I could tell them what was going on at that time. So they had a pretty good idea, but still I was able to kind of fill them in on a lot of different things that take place. Mostly probably about my friends, you know, where they were going and so forth like that, and what I had done and so forth. As I say, I wrote a lot too. I was one to write letters a lot, so I think they had a pretty good idea of what
I
was doing.
That's good, and don't forget to hang on to those letters. Can you think or tell us about how important to you was serving in the military in the United States Marine Corps?
Well, I feel very proud that I did serve for my country, and if I had to do it over again, I'd do the same thing today, I think. Maybe the only disappointment was not being able to travel a little bit more, maybe going overseas, that type of thing, John. But I feel very strongly that it was a wonderful experience. I think, you know, not everybody's cut out to go right into college, and at that time, I think in those years, people didn't have the money. I know my folks didn't have the money to send me to college, so I didn't play sports at that time until I got in the Marine Corps. I played football and judo, but I didn't have the money to go to college, so I didn't really know other than maybe just working. I had worked with Sherwin-Williams Paint Company before I went in, and maybe that's why I ended up in supply, because I told them that I used to stock the shelves for Sherwin-Williams, and the next thing I knew I was in supply, so I don't know.
But you used your GI Bill.
Yes, I did.
To get your college education.
I did, yes, I did.
That would entitle you to what, 6 years of college?
I'm not positive on the exact amount of time it did cover, but it did cover a lot of it, and I took advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. I really went to a lot of different schools. I kind of, even at Cherry Point, I went to East Carolina College and studied English literature and took some English courses at East
Good
Carolina
for you.
College when I had time. Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. You spoke earlier when we first started this interview about how you felt the serving in the Corps had affected your life. It gave you a lot of positive attributes. Can you tell us again quickly what the Corps did for you?
Well, I think it gives you a lot of gave me a lot of confidence, you know. To when I went just to for interviews with and job interviews, you know, trying to get a job and so forth, I think I had the confidence that I felt pretty confident about, you know, my abilities, you know, being still pretty young. I think what amazed me too was that the young men that were running, you know, actually performing all these different types of duties, flying aircraft, being in the ground forces, you know, and going into combat at young ages. These young fellows, you know, just young men. It's amazing what was accomplished at such a young age.
Yes.
How quickly you can learn, you know, when you really have to. And it always amazed me, you know, to think, gee, a 20-year-old or 18-year-old can do these type of things, you know, and protect our country, really. It often amazed me at that. But I was really, even today, I'm very proud that I served, and as I say,
I think I would go back and do it again, just like I did before. I'm sure.
Good for you. You said a moment ago that you left the Corps just about the time guys were going over to Vietnam.
Yes.
So you were here when those guys came home,
yes.
Those who did.
Yes.
Could you see, tell us any distinction you might see in the way men were received who had served in World War II or the Korean War, and those who had served in Vietnam, how they were met when they came home?
Well, the fellows that I went in with, there was only just this one fellow from Newton that I knew. You know, as I say, he was killed over there, so I didn't really know the other fellow that went over and served two terms of duty with over in Vietnam and lived in Tennessee. I didn't really see him return, so I don't know how he was treated at all.
I guess we're talking more generically that
yeah.
anybody
yes.
that you even read about this in the papers or how men from Vietnam, what kind of reception they got when they came back after that war.
Yes. Well, I think it's probably more from my reading in the papers and so forth, how maybe they were really, maybe weren't looked upon maybe as so much heroes because it was such a controversial type war. You know, there was so much turmoil, you know, with colleges and so forth. You know, people protesting the war and so forth like that. So I don't think they were as welcomed or, you know, as the heroes. It's maybe as so much as perhaps other times, but I'm not sure if that didn't also occur in other wars too. I wouldn't know, but you know, from Second World War and so forth too, it probably some of that maybe have taken place too. Maybe they weren't always looked up quite as, you know. But that war in particular, I guess maybe it was that way. It seemed to be, from what I read anyway, you know, with the different, all the different students, you know, protesting on campuses throughout, and the government, you know, people were questioning whether we should be over there and that type of thing too, John. There was a lot of questions, you know, that arose.
We're getting very close to the end here now, Al.
Sure.
I'd like to ask you, is there any other thought or incident or one last thing you'd like to tell your family or people who will be looking at this tape a long time from now about your service in the United States Marine Corps?
Well, I would certainly encourage young people to look to the service as a way of making a career. I don't think we have the people today like we used to have because I think a lot of young people today are more inclined to go to college, which is wonderful. I mean, they have that opportunity so much more today. There's so many more opportunities, but at the same time, I think we need to be a strong military. Have a strong military presence in throughout the world, and sometimes I question that, you know, the way things are, whether we're still as strong as we used to be. I do feel strongly that that's a wonderful start for young people, and I even encourage it with my own son because he was a little bit wasn't sure what he really wanted to do, and I said to him, I said, you know, gee, maybe why don't you sit down with? It didn't have to be the Marine Corps. You know, although he did go to the Marine Corps, to the recruiter and did talk with him, and he was very, I thought he might go, but anyway, it didn't have to be the Marines. I said, you know, Air Force, Army, Navy, whatever it would be, you know, it's a wonderful start. It gives you time to kind of get your life in order. And also, these days now, I think the military is offering a lot more for the young people. You know, they're paying them a little bit more. They're also offering, you know, college tuition, things like that, so that when they come out, you know, they'll be eventually in, you know, in the equal to other people. You know, I think when I went in, when I first started work and so forth, I found that a lot of these people already had degrees from colleges and so forth. So I felt that I was kind of always trailing behind, you know, because I had gone in and I didn't have a college degree. But eventually I was able to go nights and get my degree, but it took me a lot longer because of that. But I still feel very strongly I did the right thing.
Good for you, Al.
Yes.
Thank you very much
for
being with us.
Yes, you're welcome,
John.
Tonight. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Very good.
Thank
we
you for your time,
it.
John.
Thank you
very much.